All right, so we are actually getting really close to being done, at least topically, with the topics I wanted to cover in this series. Once we get through this lesson that we have all prepared, I think we'll maybe take this week and next week to get through. I really only have two more topics, the one being practical and then the other one being a little bit more of a philosophical, just an interesting thing on communism and socialism and biblically, how do we think about these things? How are they right or wrong biblically? As well as we'll have a lesson from Jeff that'll fit the finance study series. But we are getting very close to being to the end of it, and I'm going to continue to just kind of take my time and not rush. So we'll see how far we get. And as I've said before, too, this is different than what we normally do, where it's very heavy on Bible teaching and Bible exposition. We did a lot of that early in the series. Now we're talking about scriptures, yes, Bible principles, yes, but also a lot of practical things for us to just kick around and consider. So, we've talked about a lot of things so far, and there's many things we can have in line with our finances. We want to have the right biblical philosophy of looking at all that we have as belonging to God, and we are simply managers of it. We can get to the place where we're doing good at our job, we're making more money, we have a budget, we're planning carefully with everything that comes in, and even a little bit set aside for an emergency fund in case something comes up that we weren't expecting. All of that is great, but what about the future? A couple of quotes here. Abraham Lincoln said, "The best way to predict the future is to create it." Another one, "The future starts today, not tomorrow." And I don't know who said this one, but this one has stuck in my mind for a long time. "The days are long, but the years are short." So in other words, you're waiting for the baby to be born. You measure from new year to new year. You're looking at things that are coming up. It seems as if it takes forever, but all of a sudden you turn around and look back and you say, was that really 7 years ago? Was I really 10 years younger then? Did I really look that different? Life flies by. So if we don't take time to prepare for the future in many different aspects, we're not going to be successful. We need a plan to follow to think not just about today or tomorrow, long term. So in many areas of life, we trust God, but we try to plan for the future. We say, well, I trust God for my health and my life, but we also try to not live a self-destructive lifestyle where we're killing ourselves decades earlier than maybe we could have lived if we just totally didn't take care of our body, or if we were a drug addict or destroyed our liver by drinking alcohol all the time, whatever that may be. Yes, we want to say, well, trust God by faith, but we also make a plan to try to follow to the best of our ability. And this obviously should apply to our finances. We should seek to live our lives as Christians and seek to prepare our finances in a way where, yes, we are prepared to die. If the Lord were to call us home unexpectedly tomorrow, we should be ready to say, Lord, to the best of my ability, though I wasn't wanting or thinking I would die this soon, I'm ready to meet the Lord because Jesus is my Savior. I've tried to repent of all my sins. I've tried to make things right with my brothers and sisters in Christ. I've tried to love my family. So if God calls me home tomorrow, there shouldn't be anything in my mind that I'm going, oh, I was going to take care of this, or I wish I had more time to get right with God. So too with our finances, it is wise to devise a plan where we're not consumed with a love of money, where we're not lustful after building wealth and loving our wealth more than we love God or people, yet we could hopefully make a plan with our finances that we could prepare to live for a long or even longer than normal lifestyle and hopefully have a plan to execute and to follow. I think it was during the first lesson in this series, I told you about the man in our church who, when I was just barely like a preteen age, I remember him talking to my father and he said, yeah, we're refinancing our house and I'm pulling out as much equity out of my house as I can so I can have the money now. And the man, I think, was in his 30s, maybe his early 40s. And he said, I think Jesus is coming back soon, so I'm not worried about having equity in my house or having my house paid off. And that's just one of those things that on surface level can sound spiritual. But as we said, a lot of people can be hyper spiritual on the subject of money, and it's actually just kind of unwise. So could Jesus come back tomorrow? Yes, he could. Is there war in the Middle East? Yes, there is. Has there been war in the Middle East the last 2,000 years? Yes, there has been. And for all we know, it could continue for quite some time. So the idea I'm trying to put forth is spiritually, we're ready in our mind to say, Jesus, you take me out of this life or take away what I have at any time, and I'm ready to surrender to your will. But if you want to give me a life where I live to 80 or 90 years old, then let me have a plan to live by. That's not immature. That's not unspiritual. It's not loving the things of this world to plan that way. It's simply being wise and following wise biblical principles. As we've said several times, the idea of money and having money and how we manage it and buying things with our money and growing our money is not a bad thing. Even Jesus' disciples had a money bag, and they might have should have watched it closer because Judas stole out of the money bag. But even Jesus sanctioned a plan where they would have a bag with money so when they traveled around, they could buy the things that were necessary. Somebody said, if all of us, every Christian, said, boy, we're just burdened with the need to reach the gospel. What are we waiting for? We're all going to die someday. People are perishing. And if tomorrow morning, every Christian on the face of the planet liquidated every penny they could and gave it all away by the end of the day, what would happen if next week an emergency need arose? In the book of Acts, there were people who had done well in that society in Jerusalem. They had obtained enough wealth to buy property. And when Jewish people began to get saved and receive Jesus as the Messiah, they got persecuted. And there was a group of people that said, we will sell our property, take that money, and give it to support these people who are being martyred for the cause of Christ. And it even says something about the fact that they took all of the proceeds and gave it to the apostles so they could have it in common. And some people will say, well, there, the Bible supports socialism or the Bible supports communism. Several reasons for why that's not true, but one reason is it was voluntary. They came in an extreme time and gave extremely generously from their heart to care for their brothers and sisters in Christ. And if it was a society where no one was allowed to accrue wealth or buy property, then nobody would have had property to sell when that great need arose to be able to support these people. So sadly, in America specifically, many preachers, when they were trained for the ministry, were told things like, don't ever have a plan B. Don't learn any other skills or work in two different things while you do the ministry, because that will just give you an escape plan and you'll be tempted to quit the ministry. Some people were told, never retire. You don't need a retirement plan. Just preach in your pulpit till the day you drop dead. I heard one preacher say, I'm not worried about retirement because I'll just work till I die. And if I can't work, I'll just let my kids take care of me. But the truth of the matter is, everybody would be wise to plan for their future and to invest for the day when we might not have the health and the strength that we currently have. So the United States government made a provision in the law where preachers are allowed to opt out of paying into Social Security. They can say, I don't want my wages withheld. I don't want to pay into Social Security. You say, what do you think about that? I think that is actually a good thing for preachers to do that if they were to take that exact same amount of money they were going to pay into Social Security and invest it into a portfolio that grows at a higher rate than Social Security does. But what happened is a lot of preachers opted out of Social Security and they didn't have any other kind of investment plan for the future. And I think it would be wise for any church that's a healthy, growing church with plenty of money from God's people giving generously to meet the need, and they get to the place where we say we want a full-time pastor. I think part of how they structure his benefits and salary should be some type of a matching program where they encourage him to set money aside for his future, and then the church would match that the same way that your employer might offer that same kind of program for you. Now, I'm part-time, and I'm very happy to be part-time my whole life if that's what God wants. People ask me about that. Do you have this burning desire to be a full-time pastor? And I say, not really. The idea of it kind of makes me nervous, especially if the church is too small to support it in a healthy manner. But if there was a need, and it really was needed, and the church was telling me that's what we want, I would be open to doing so. But I do think that the church and all of you should realize that if you ever do get a full-time pastor, either me or somebody else, that that is a normal thing. That's an okay thing. That's a good thing. That's supported biblically through the teachings of the Apostle Paul. And that you should set up wisely a way to care for him in the current and hopefully in the future as well. Now, the current reality is that people who are called to the ministry at a young age, unless they have some connection through their family or their ministry, they're probably not going to go to Bible college for 4 years and then get called to pastor a church of 300 people that's able to pay them a generous salary. It's just the reality of the fact that in America, religion of all kinds and church attendance of all kind is on the decline. So I think it would be wise for people who have a burden for the ministry to train very deeply and rigorously in learning the Bible and in the theology of it and in the practicality of managing all aspects of being a leader in the church. But I think it would also be wise for them to work and to learn other skills in the meantime, so that if they do go to what I see anyway as the most common situation of a church who needs a pastor, the most common situation I see is we have a building, we don't have debt, we might even have a parsonage, but we have 25 people and we can't afford to pay the pastor much. And we need somebody to come travel here, move away from their family, and give their life to help us try to rebuild the ministry. That's a good thing. That's the calling that is currently necessary. But that would mean that a lot of people who need to go into the ministry should prepare for the fact that they might not get paid at all, or they might only get paid a little bit. So a lot of preachers, to cope with this, either they're working other secular jobs, or some of them are having their wives work just enough so their family can get benefits. Otherwise, they wouldn't really have a shot at getting health care. Or some of them are going on to the exchanges and finding ways that they're offered at that discounted rate, because as a normal course of business, it's very difficult for someone to go to Bible college for 4 years and then plan that for the rest of their life, they're going to be supported at a full-time salary. That is not the case in many ministries currently in America. So sometimes pastors don't retire because they don't have any other option and they never made a plan. And it would have been better to plan for this day to come. And I want to say this, I'm not just picking on pastors, but for all of us, we all know the day is coming when our body's going to slow down. We all know the day is coming when we're not going to be able to function physically and mentally at the highest level that we always have. So pastors, as well as everyone else, should invest and plan for the future the best that they can. And the other aspect of that is I've heard there are some denominations, like certain Presbyterian denominations, where the ministries are still struggling. They're offering, if they hire a full-time pastor, something like $55,000-$60,000 a year. But they're saying, we require for you to have an MDiv, which takes like 8 years. And if you're going to the accredited schools, you're going way into debt. So they're running these guys through this long, massive program of schooling and certification, and they're coming out of school with a whole lot of student debt they need to pay off, and then the church is barely able to pay them anything, as far as, you know, that you would think of a wealthy or healthy salary. So then the church probably has it backwards there too, where the church would do better to just train their own people and train them to where men can be ordained to go into the ministry. And education, yes, is important, but education isn't just about the certificate on the wall. So I thought about this, and I was just thinking last year, I think there's four things that if we're younger, and all of us have a future no matter what, but speak to people my age bracket, speak to people who are younger. When you look at the future, I think there's four things that you'd be very wise to think intentionally about and to plan for, that when you get older, you'll wish you had done a good job in these areas, at least the best that you can. One is your body, taking care of your physical health. The other one is your family and your relationships. You don't want to get to a certain age and realize that you burned every bridge with relationships that you had, and wish that you had treated your spouse better, or your kids or your parents after they die, wish that you'd honored them more. So your body, your family, your relationships, and then I would say your character. I don't think any of us want to get to a certain age and look back and say, well, I ruined my marriages because of infidelity. Well, I was disqualified from ministry because of public sins that were really embarrassing. If we're intentional and plan and say, God, help me walk with you, I don't think any of us will regret getting older in life and looking back and saying, thank you, God, that you helped me live a life of character, not sinless perfection, but a life of character to the best of my ability. And then the fourth one that we're talking about, obviously, is our money. Some intentionality and some planning for the future in our finances can really pay off later. One other kind of random thought I had is that the Jewish people, are known by and large for being really good with their money. And in Israel, even today, they're on the cutting edge of technology for research in a lot of different areas, from weapons to medicinal treatments and all those types of things. So there's one extreme group that will say, well, yeah, the Jews have all the money because the Jews are secretly controlling everything in the world, and they're part of a cabal that controls everything, and I don't have it because the Jews stole it and the Jews are evil. That's what anti-Semitic conspiracy theory people say. I would like to say I think it's because they have lived by wise biblical principles from the Old Testament. And when we live according to God's principles, we experience God's blessing. So let's look at a couple of points here tonight. Number one in your outline, planning for the future is a sign of wisdom and maturity. Proverbs 22:3 and Proverbs 27:12 repeat the exact same phrases twice here in the book of Proverbs. A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. And there's other verses we'll read under other points, even coming up in just a second, that talk about looking ahead beyond just today. But the simple meaning of this proverb is that a man who is prudent and wise will look ahead and see what's coming. The idea specifically in this verse is looking ahead at evil and seeing people who head down this path are headed for a lot of trouble. I'm going to hide myself from it. But the simple man, or the one who lacks understanding, passes on without thinking about the end of the road he's on, and he ends up being punished as a result. That's a general principle. It's talking primarily about avoiding evil, but the principle is repeated often in Scripture that it's a sign of wisdom and maturity to think beyond today and look for things that we know are going to come in the future. So think about it. Long-term planning is a natural, it at least is supposed to be a natural consequence of getting older and gaining wisdom. If you let your kids decide how they want to live, they will not consider the long term. They will consider the short term. They won't even consider the long term as far as a day. They will consider the short term as far as right now. They would eat ice cream for every meal and never go to sleep until they literally run around on a sugar high and smash their head into a wall if you let them make their own decisions, because they're focused on the short term. They have no concept of delayed gratification, putting something off we want now for later so that it will ultimately be beneficial for us. So as adults, we're supposed to think about the future. And adults probably don't eat ice cream for dinner every night or refuse to sleep until their body passes out. But some adults live by the philosophy, when it comes to money even, of have fun, spend it all. It's too hard to get away anyway. Life is short. Might as well enjoy all that I had. I worked really hard Monday through Friday, so I might as well go spend everything I have on Saturday night, and I'll figure the rest out later. One of those lines of immature thinking is to constantly be complaining, well, it's stacked against the little man. The little man can't get ahead. If Washington would just get it kicked into gear, then maybe my life could be successful and I could figure it out. Now, I get as upset at anyone at seeing what they're doing in Washington and how it is making it harder on all of us. But if you spend your life making those excuses and hoping for things that are outside of your control to get better, you're not going to be as successful as if you understand, I may not be able to control what everybody else does, but I've got control over what I do. I can make a plan. I can do the best I can in the short term and the long term. Any goal that is worth accomplishing requires discipline and planning. We don't accidentally lose weight, and we don't accidentally do well with our money. It takes devising a plan and then trying to be disciplined as we can in meticulously following it. So planning for the future is a sign of wisdom and maturity. Number two, saving is necessary for the short term. We've read these verses already, but let me read to you from Proverbs 6 again. Saving is necessary for the short term. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So thy poverty shall come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. So we talked about those verses before, but the concept is a warning against laziness. And it talks about the sluggard, the lazy man, who he's saying, oh, just a little sleep, a little sleep. It's not saying you're lazy if you want to get a little bit of sleep at night. It's saying he makes that excuse. It's time to get up and go to work, but he says, oh, just a little more sleep, a little more rest. I've got time. And if he doesn't learn to discipline his body to get up and work hard, he's going to end up in poverty because he's not being disciplined in his work. But what was the example? It was the ants. He said, go look at the ant and study the science of how the ant colony operates. And see, it said in verse 8, how the ant provides her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in harvest. The idea being the ant prepares ahead of time for when it's going to change to winter and they won't be able to gather. So one story from Market Watch said that one study made a claim. And that claim was over 36% of Americans may be unprepared to handle an unexpected car repair of $500 or more. So let me repeat, if we don't have a lot of money or if we're struggling, that doesn't make us unspiritual. It doesn't automatically make us unwise. Sometimes we're in that situation, but it does make us unwise if we're not doing the best we can and say we did have plenty, but we spent too much and didn't account for the fact that maybe we would need to repair something like that. That's not really a wise way, at least to plan to try to have our finances. In the story of Joseph, in the book of Genesis, God gave him a warning that a time of famine was coming. And there's always a time of famine coming. It may not be that specifically, but what did your grandparents say? Save up a little bit for a rainy day. It's going to rain eventually. So layoffs, pandemics, things like that, injuries will happen to us in our lifetime, and it's wise to do the best we can to be prepared for those things. So for very short-term goals, we save. And then what we'll go into next is that for long-term goals, we invest. The shorter the goal, the less you want to risk it by investing it. The longer the goal, the more you want to invest so that you grow what you have. If you have an extremely short-term goal of saving for something for 3 to 6 or 7 months you want to pay cash for, you don't really need to be putting that in investments that go up and down over time. But even if you knew that it was in 2 years you wanted it, you might be able to put it, park it in an account where it gets a teeny little bit of interest and you park it there. But if you're saying for the long term, way down the road, I want to have this for a specific goal, that's when you want to be investing it so that it grows instead of just sitting there. Okay, so planning for the future is a sign of wisdom and maturity. Saving is necessary for the short term. And then number three, investing is important for the long term. Let's look at a passage of scripture here. This is probably the lengthiest passage I have in this whole outline. In Matthew chapter 24 and 25, Jesus is answering his disciples' question. They asked him, when would the temple be overthrown? What is the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? What follows next in Matthew 24 and 25 is some of the deepest and sometimes most confusing teachings on prophecy, where Jesus references the book of Daniel and he talks about what's going to happen halfway through the tribulation period and what things are going to look like as we head to the end and how us as his disciples are supposed to be ready. In Matthew 25, he talks about the judgment of the nations and how Christ will come to the earth at the end of the tribulation period. And here he repeats the idea that he introduced in Matthew 24 of warning his disciples to be ready because Jesus could come back. So if we live life expecting that Jesus could return, it should help us live with an expectancy of saying, Jesus could come back at any time. I could die at any time. So let me be busy doing the will of God. Let me invest in his kingdom. Let me tell the gospel. Let me live for the Lord Jesus Christ. So in the beginning of Matthew 25, I think he tells the parable of the seven virgins and how some of them had oil in their lamp. They were ready for Jesus to come back. Some of them were asleep and they were completely unprepared. So what I want to say and make clear, let me take a drink here. Everybody doing all right?
Yeah.
It might be a little bit more stuffy in here than usual tonight with this extreme heat. So hopefully everybody's doing okay and I'll plan to not go too long. So the main thrust of this parable is telling the disciples, be ready, Jesus is coming back. But the example he uses of a bad servant is a servant who didn't take the resources he had, the money he had, and look to handle it wisely and to grow it. So hear me clearly, the purpose and the main teaching of the parable is not about money, but he uses money to make the point, which does help teach us something about money as well as the main point. Matthew 25:13. Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1. Every man according to his several or his individual ability, and straightway took his journey. Now a talent is a weight or a measurement of money. Somebody said it was this many shekels. Whatever it was, if you referred to a talent, you were referring to a certain denomination of money as they would weigh it out and say there, that's 1 talent. So to some people, 1 servant got 5, 1 got 2, and another got 1. The idea then is the master gave his servants this amount of money to manage, and he traveled away into a far country with the expectation, I'm coming back someday. Do you see the parallels to Jesus and how Jesus has given all of us resources? It's not about finances primarily, but it includes finances. It includes our health, our knowledge of the truth, what we do with the time he gives us. Jesus is saying, I give you things to manage for me, and I'm coming back, and then I'm going to check on how you did managing what I gave you. And in the parable, it's money. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made them other 5 talents. So he took 5, he invested it, and it grew to 10. Verse 17. And likewise, he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. He disobeys the expectation of the master. He goes and hides what he's been given in the earth instead of freely using it to see his master's possessions grow. And after a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And Jesus is going to come back and there's going to be a reckoning for all of us what we did with our opportunities. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliveredest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of the Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. This aspect of the story has been a great encouragement to me many times. To look and see in the parable, the master that represented God looked at his servant, and he looked at the one who started with 5 and ended up with 10, and he said, Good job. Then he looked at the one who started out with 2, and ended up with 4, and he said, Good job. And someday when you and I stand before God, we're not going to be judged on the quantity of what we did with measurable results. We're going to be judged on the quality of what we did with what He gave us. So I believe you can get to heaven and hear, Well done, thou good and faithful servant, the same as Moses did, even though you didn't lead the nation of Israel and get your life written about in the Bible and oversee miracles done. Why? God didn't call you to be Moses. He didn't ask you to do what Moses did. And Moses didn't gain his righteousness by his good works. Moses was a servant of the Lord who took the opportunities in front of him that God entrusted him with and was faithful to do his best. And if you are faithful and I am faithful, we will get an accommodation from the Lord, no matter if people look and see through their perception that we have been successful or not. I think this story also teaches us the principle that Jesus oft repeated. If we want Him to entrust us with big things, we have to be faithful in the little things. Well, if I had a lot of money, then I would give to God. Maybe, but it gets harder sometimes to give away significant chunks of your money the more wealth that you have. Why are we praying for God to give us more money if we're not being faithful with the money we have or giving to the Lord the best we can from the money He's already given us? Well, Lord, give me something I don't have and I'll manage it well, even though I'm not managing well what You've already given me. That's not what God expects of us. Okay, verse 24. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went, and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, here thou hast, that is thine. His Lord answered, and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. The word there for usury simply means interest. Okay, so it's a heavy parable. I'm not rebuking us for saying if you're not investing, then God's putting His wrath on you. I'm just saying the example God used was the wise servants invested with interest and traded and grew what they had. And in the story, it was money. So it's a wise principle to take our money and to be able to invest it and to see it grow. Verse 28. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even what he hath. So the whole idea here is sort of a reverse socialism. Jesus didn't say, well, this guy did bad, so take from the guy who did well and give it to him. He said, take it from the one who did bad and give it to the others who did well, which is just kind of interesting. And then verse 30, cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So good spiritual principles, and the practical one there is sort of a small aspect, but it's still an aspect that Jesus used in that story to illustrate his point. So we've got a little bit more time to push forward here tonight and to finish up this point. Our generation is being called the sandwich generation. Anybody have any idea what that's referring to? It's referring to the fact that a lot of people find themselves in a situation where they have a parent living upstairs that can't really care for themselves financially, and they have a child living in the basement downstairs who's not getting a job and caring for themselves financially. So maybe the parents had an expectation of, well, my kids will just take care of me. And now the kids are trying the adults are trying to accomplish their own goals while caring for their parents, while having a college graduate who's not getting a job and not really getting able to get ahead and get their own place like other people have done quite as easily at other points in history. Let me just give you one example of, in our culture, what we can invest in. So what I'll give you is just basically a couple of facts. And I won't be able to get through all that I want to say about aspects of it till I get to next week. So I hope you'll come back. We'll have a question time here at the end if you want to ask a question. But sometimes I might answer that question by saying we'll cover it next week. But here's the 5-second thought. So here's just one example. Throughout the last couple of decades, if somebody in a regular menial job working career had invested consistently in the United States, in the stock market, they would have grown an investment portfolio big enough to care for themselves at retirement through the principle of compound interest, where you give an investment and you keep giving to the exact same investment. You don't pull any of it out. So you grow your interest, but then you grow interest on what you're paying over and over again. And the math, the longer you keep it in there, it grows better and better and better. So the basic idea of the stock market is that there are companies who want to aggressively grow their business. And what they do is they sell shares in the business. So if you want to buy a share in their business, you put dollars into that share, you own stock in that company. The company then takes all of the money that they raised and they aggressively invest and use that money to grow their business. So if the business does well over time, then your shares do well over time and you make money that way. How do you make money in the stock market? Investors make money in the stock market by exchanging their money for shares. Companies then take that money and put it to work, growing and expanding their business. And investors reap the benefits as their shares of stock become more valuable over time, leading to capital gains. So I'm not pretending to be any kind of expert or understand it the best, but that's the basic concept. And when you go to invest, which is what we'll talk about, I think next week at this point, a wise biblical principle is diversification. So you could take all of your money that you want to invest and put it in one company, but that's very risky because that company could do poorly. But when you buy funds where you're investing in hundreds and hundreds or thousands of companies at once, you're upping your probability of doing well over time, because if some of them do poorly, then you still can make money from the other ones doing better. Okay? So this is just some simple math and some facts here to consider. If you were to take, sorry, this is just screenshotted and I just threw it right up there without editing it off, so my open tabs are up there and everything. Don't get distracted. If you were to take $500 and invest that $500 and then every month for 40 years, say you get a job at 20, you do that between 20 and 60, you invest $500 into that account every single month. If you get a 6% rate of return on that money. Now again, that's not 6% coming out every month. That's you never touch it. You let it grow. You get 6% as your yearly average. You end up with over $1 million when you're 60 years old. If you get 8% on that same equation, it's 1.7 million. And if you got a flat 10%, that's $3.1 million. So the S&P 500 is one small snapshot of what the entire market does as a whole. The S&P 500 is 500 companies that are rated highly. And if you want to get into that club, you got to meet certain standards. So you can go and invest directly into the S&P 500 and your money grows in proportion to how those 500 companies grow their business. Okay? So the stock market as a whole is not just the S&P 500. And as we'll talk about later, there's actually Warren Buffett says, just invest in the S&P 500, nothing else, you'll be fine. Other people like Dave Ramsey say, get a more diversified portfolio where you're buying a little bit of international stocks as well as divvying up the type that you own in the stock market. But when you look at the S&P 500, you can sort of take a snapshot of what the stock market has done as a whole since its inception. And there's other investment plans that are more diversified with more companies, but that are very comparable to what the S&P 500 has done since its inception. Okay? So the S&P 500 is market capitalization weighted index of the 500 leading publicly traded companies in the United States. The index is operated by S&P's Dow Jones, which is a division of S&P Global. So while it's assumed its present size and name in 1957, the S&P itself dates back to the 1920s, where it's sort of been a way to track it since 1926, okay? So the averaged annualized return since its inception in 1928 through December 31st, 2023 is 9.9%. The average annualized return since adopting 500 stocks into the index in 1957 through December 31st, 2003 is 10.2%. So all that to say, investing in the S&P 500 ever since it has existed, if you leave it there and never touch it and don't try to time the market and pull it out when the market's doing bad and get in when you think it can do good, you always average, given enough time, a 10% rate of return, which is what we said right here. $500 a month for your working career would have put over $300 million into your retirement account. Let me see if this was something else that I wanted to read here or not. I think that's kind of repeating it all. Historic return is around 10.2%. While the average number may sound attractive, timing is everything. If you're in at a high or out at a low, you will not enjoy such returns. So my work, since I work for the federal government, the program is called Thrift's Savings Plan. It's a TSP, and there are well over 100,000 federal workers currently who don't make super high annualized incomes that are millionaires just off of the value of their Thrift Savings Plan because they invested slowly and consistently over time. Investopedia says this: the U.S. stock market has long been considered the source of the greatest returns for investors, outperforming all other types of investments, including financial securities, real estate, commodities, and art collectibles over the past century. So what's it going to do in the future? That's something we'll talk about in a little bit. The idea is we don't know for sure, but the facts are that any working person who consistently invested a very small percentage of their income throughout their working career would have been a millionaire at the end of their working career if they had invested in that one avenue that we have here in this capitalistic society, which is pretty blessed. Oh man, I have a lot under this next point, and I'm kind of torn. Do I want to go 10 more minutes, or do I just want to pause and park it here? Why don't I go at least a couple more, okay? Because this will give a little bit of idea of what I'm saying. Number four, patience is required to build wealth. There are several scriptures that indicate we are vulnerable to foolishness if we want to always be trying to jump in on what is called a get-rich-quick scheme. Somebody says, I found a shortcut. I've got a way for you to super quick get rich and bypass the idea of slowly accumulating it over the years. Sometimes that might work, but a lot of the times that leaves you vulnerable to getting taken advantage of and making unwise decisions. And it can kind of be a lustful thing, a desire to get riches, love of money thing, to be super consumed with the idea, how do I get rich? And get rich really fast. Okay, Proverbs 21:5. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. So you're diligent, you're consistent. What is the word that verse there says it tends to? What does it lead to? Plenteousness, to blessing, to having more than we need. But everyone that is hasty, it leads to being in want, or to having a lack, or to having a need. So the old story of the tortoise and the hare is really a wise proverb financially, but in many different areas of life, if we're just in a rush to get to the top and we're trying to cut corners and do it faster than anyone else has ever done it, we're very susceptible to making bad mistakes. But when we're diligent and patient, it in the long run leads to us having plenty. Ecclesiastes 7:8. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So when we're wise, what do? We consider the end. We think long term. Proverbs 28:20, a faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. Proverbs 13:11. You know what happens overwhelmingly to a lot of people who win the lottery and become a millionaire overnight? They lose it because they didn't work hard for it through diligent planning, so they're not prepared to be able to handle it. So whether wealth gotten by vanity is speaking of unethical, sinful means, or simply a vain thing that's not really worth anything, it's going to be diminished. But if we gather it by our labor, not only are we gathering, but we're establishing healthy habits that will help us continue to prosper. And the guy who, you know, not stereotype too much, but the guy in the South that lives in a trailer park that wins the lottery, he hasn't established any healthy habits. And it's very likely he'll mismanage his large sum of money the same way that he's mismanaged lower sums of money. So gambling is one thing that comes to mind when I think about this. Gambling is one of those issues where people could say, tell me, where does the Bible say it's a sin to gamble? And I don't think I can give you a chapter and verse. And I think if someone were to come and say, I work really hard and I take $50 a month, that's it. Some people take that $50 a month and they use it to go out to restaurants. I take that $50 a month and I play the slot machines, or I try to guess, you know, who's going to win the sports game. I gamble it. I'm even pretty good. I win a little sometimes. Prove to me that's a sin. That's one of those things I don't think I can prove is a sin, and I'm not super worried about trying to, but what I can say is gambling is one of those things that by its very nature is not a wise habit, or not really wise biblically, at least in my opinion, as I look at the scriptures. When we're gambling, it triggers something in our brain that says, I can get rich quick. I can gain something I didn't work for. It's also saying, I can beat the other guy. I can be smarter than him. I can take what he has by winning at the card table or by guessing the outcome of the sports game or whatever it may be better than him. I'm going to take his money. And the statistics say that anywhere from 2 to 20 million Americans are addicted to gambling or show some sign of danger of being susceptible to gambling addiction. I heard one statistic say that online sports betting is the second highest addicting behavior in young men, only under online pornography. So young men are having access through their cell phone to bet on sports or to play online poker. And sure, we waste a little money for fun. What's the big deal? Maybe it's not. But maybe your brain gets triggered to say, well, I lost, but I can get it back. And we go and we go and we go. And we're sort of by nature trying to make a gain we didn't work for, which is why so many people struggle with being addicted to gambling. Many different scams will prey on our desire to get rich quick. Let's watch a 3-minute video and then we'll see if there's any questions or comments and then we'll be done. Okay? So it's going to take me a second to switch it over because I couldn't load this one into the slide program. But this is my coworker who I worked with for nearly 10 years. I don't think he'd ever listen to this. I really don't. But if he did, he decided to go on the news and publicly share his story, stating that he was hoping other people wouldn't fall for the same type of thing that he fell prey to. So use it what he desired it for, which is be careful and don't let this happen to you. Be wise, be careful. Don't let your desire to quickly grow wealth let your guard go down. So give me a second to switch it over. I'll play it. It's 3 minutes, and then we'll pause there till next week.
Cryptocurrency is the hot new trend in investing, but because it doesn't rely on banks to verify transactions, it can be fertile ground for scams. Meredith Yeoman shares the story of a North Texas veteran who says he was swindled out of hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Nobody comes back being the same.
James Cashel is an Army veteran who served in the Gulf War. He spent the last 16 years working for the post office, and when he left last year, says he started looking into investing in cryptocurrency to make extra money.
Surprisingly, at the time I was thinking of looking into doing it, here comes a message.
The message on WhatsApp was from someone who said their name was Katharina and offered to help and teach James how to invest in crypto.
I'll give you a trial, see if you'll be willing to want to make some money.
It started, he says, with a small transaction last July through what he thought was a crypto trading site. But as his trust in Katharina grew, so did his investments.
I actually still have everything.
About 6 months, more than 100 pages worth of messages.
One, two, three.
And dozens of transactions later, he says he tried to withdraw money from the $4 million he was told he made.
And they were saying, oh, you gotta do this first because, you know, even flagged.
He says he spent weeks getting the runaround, realizing it was all a scam, and that the app he thought was a trading site was actually a clone of a real crypto marketplace.
That is heartbreaking.
His biggest regret? Using money that was supposed to pay for his mom's assisted living.
I've probably lost between 50 to 60.
So total how much?
Probably about $230,000.
It's a giant gamble.
Magnus Carter is a crypto enthusiast who just wrote a book for beginners. He says crypto crooks go to great lengths to get what they want and often get away with it.
There's a lot of uncertainty with it. There's no federal guidelines with it. There's no laws that can actually stop somebody from actually doing things and no regulations for people to follow.
James says he filed a complaint with the FTC.
Nothing.
After his profile on that cloned app disappeared, along with any hope of seeing a dime of his money again. In Plano, Meredith Yeomans, NBC 5.
James says he is sharing his story so others don't fall victim too. For tips on how to avoid crypto scams, just go to this story at NBCDFW.com.
Okay, so the idea of what he was investing in isn't really the point. It's that somebody on WhatsApp contacted him and said, I'll teach you how to invest. And through one source of putting all of his eggs into one basket, he had an app that had cloned legitimate apps where you invest in crypto. And he transferred over $220,000 that I think part of it was his mom's nest egg he was supposed to be managing that was to care for her, and he never saw a penny of that money back. And the point being, the desire to get rich really quick can do things to our brain that causes us to make horrible decisions, as well as the fact he was putting all of his eggs into one basket. So his app told him he had made $4 million, and when he wanted to take some out, he found out that the $230,000 he'd put in, he had been scammed, and that was by jumping at one person on WhatsApp who contacted him. So absolutely tragic, and a good reminder to just remember that was under the heading of patience, and a long-term plan is always better than trying to jump at something that we think will make us rich quick. That leads us to make foolish decisions. We'll start next week by giving more examples of that. I'll have a little bit more to say about the stock market and things like that that we talked about. But where we were tonight, did anyone have a question or anything to add on any of that? And for those who don't know, you're in the crypto security business, right? So I'm sure, the cybersecurity. Yeah. Yes, that's what I was trying to say. Cybersecurity, so I'm sure you've heard of many stories like that.
I know terrible people that have been pumped. You build blockchains. No, I don't. But I have definitely helped some people because, you know, if there's enough evidence and you can provide enough evidence to the FBI, if there's ever a raid and they get that money back down the road, and it could be 5-10 years down the road, they will return that money if there is a paper trail. And so giving them as much of a paper trail as possible is great because they're getting a lot better tracking these guys down and shut them down.
Well, that's definitely wise counsel, and then I'm sure there's also a likely possibility too. It could be somebody in another country and you'll never see it, right? That's certainly possible. Worth pursuing anyway, the right way. Yeah. Any other quick example that comes to mind of scams people have fallen for, like seniors that are online type thing like that?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the number one problem right now is business email compromise. Someone's email gets compromised. They send an invoice to a client for, you know, $40,000 $50,000 pre-purchase for some item, and a hacker's watching that. And so what they'll do is they'll send a reply just after that invoice and say, hey, don't send the wire to that information, send it to this.
Sort of an intercept.
And so they intercept the wire fraud, essentially, wire fraud.
I saw just last month Mark Cuban got his email hacked. One guy pretended to be Gmail and he just gave away all this information. But the scams are getting so high level too, where they can clone source phone numbers. So they can call you and you can say, oh, that's really Nebraska Furniture Mart customer service department. You could give them your credit card and that could be somebody in their house cloning Nebraska Furniture Mart cell phone number, as well as supposedly the AI. You can clone somebody's voice in 30 seconds. So you could have a family member on the phone basically that's not them and it would trick you. That's how good the cloning is. So anyway, little bit off topic. Not all of that is a desire to get rich quick, but it's good to remember to be careful around finances too and secure with what we do.
Anything has to do with money. It does never hurt to call a friend and say, you know, this is the situation, what you thought.
Amen.
You know, and especially somebody like me who I've been around it all and I've seen it all. And so, you know, I can definitely point somebody in the right direction and go, well, what about this or this or this? This is your checklist of things to look at to determine if that's right or not.
The other one I've heard is strangers on the street. Oh, my car's broke down. Can I have your phone? You hand them your phone. They can open your Venmo and send money to themselves before you realize what happened.
Yeah. I'll take your picture, and then they take your picture and run.
It's just, it makes me mad. It's like people really, that's all you can do with your energy. You can't find something else to do and try to steal. Yes, ma'am.
My elderly neighbor, she had one last year where she was called, and they said that your daughter's been in an accident. Her daughters are grown. She's like close to 80 years old. But your daughter's been in an accident, and she's okay, but we have her right here. And yeah, it was her fault in the accident. And so, which none of this makes sense anyway, but when you're all freaked out that you've just been told that your daughter's in an accident, and that we've already contacted law enforcement is here, and we've already contacted an attorney or whatever. So we're going to need you to go ahead and approve this attorney, you know, because they, you know, that she would have to pay so that they can get this going, because we want to make sure that your daughter, and then on top of it, like, this could be the AI thing, whatever, they had her daughter supposedly crying, saying, Mom, you know, I'm okay, but I'm really upset, and, you know, whatever, and you have to do this, otherwise I'm going to get in a lot of trouble, they told me, because it's my fault, but they've got this attorney. You know, and
that's so sad.
She didn't really, I mean, she kind of fell for it, but she didn't fall for it where she was, you know, getting her charge card out. But talk about, like, because you're not thinking.
She's a little smarter than the average.
Right, but you're still freaked out. So you're not thinking of, you know, you're just thinking, oh my word. Okay.
And also, us younger people got to have compassion. Older people didn't grow up with all this technology, so they're at a real disadvantage.
The number one thing scammers will do is evoke emotion. And never make a decision or do anything based on emotion, because that's the number one thing they do. Even on stupid computers, whenever those dumb websites come up and you got malware installed, it'll full screen that thing and play a loud alert and everything else and just scare people to death. And it evokes that emotion. They're going, oh my goodness, I got to do this. No.
Yeah, when we're emotional instead of using our mind, we're susceptible. The only one I ever fell for, it made me so mad. I figured it out right after, but we had been playing for a while that some of those CDs through the speakers, and it was coming through the live stream, and Facebook had muted it a time or two because they're watching like copyright and all that. So I already knew that, and then I got a message saying this is Facebook and we're shutting down the church page because you violated copyright law. So I was like signing in, and then I figured out I was given my password. It wasn't Facebook. It was, and I'm like, what does somebody want with the Facebook password? And then I changed it all, but anyway. You can, yeah, you can't be too careful.
They sell them. I mean, they can go out there on the dark web, and you can see, we've got 1,000 Facebook username and passwords validated. We'll sell them for $3 each, and you know, and that's about all they'll get for them. But that's money to them. So, anyways, and then someone else can take it, and who specializes maybe in fraud or whatever else. We'll take that information, get those logins, and then use that logins to run whatever scheme that they're a pro at.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, one last thing.
Yeah, go for it.
Late, but you really, really, really got to watch things because, I follow on Telegram some investment stuff, and just because I'm literally in a particular investment channel, somebody will pull me into this group, and they will start dropping videos and everything that look like legitimate investment opportunities, and I'm telling you, they look so good because they are AI generated. The videos are AI generated. Literally, I showed her because I was like, watch this video. Tell me what you think about it. And it's Warren Buffett saying you need to invest in this and this and this.
And they made it. Yeah, it's AI. Video. I've seen those on YouTube where I'm like, I know that's not a real.
Yeah, and you go to the next video, and it's somebody else, you know, saying you need to invest in this and this. And it just keeps going down. People saying, I turned in my money and I made this much. It's all AI generated and it looks so real. And unless you have a really well-trained eye, you won't spot it. It took her a little bit. She started figuring it out. I'm like, she realized I was handing it to her. Like, can you figure this out? And it's like the little square box where they make the deep fake that you can just barely see it. And something about the fake.
And it may get better. Right. It's going to keep getting better, too.
It's going to get better and better. And eventually you're not going to be able to tell.
Well, thank you for sharing all that with your expertise. And all that to say, if we're going to be good stewards of what God's given us, not losing it in scams is a good way to do that. So we're 10 minutes over. Anybody else that really wanted to say something quick to add? All right. God bless you all. Thank you for coming out. We'll see you Sunday.